Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the Newseum in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking today to Patty Rule, who is Director of Exhibit Development at the Newseum. It has an exhibition right now called CNN Politics Election 2016, Like, Share, Elect. Patty, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
And we're hearing some strange, almost video game-like noises. Tell us a little bit about the place we're standing.
Okay, you are right here in the center of this exhibit, and it's almost like being in a campaign war room. There's information in here that both candidates and potential voters would be very interested in. And we've got a deep dive. A lot of people are calling this the data campaign or the social media campaign. Obviously, Barack Obama did amazing things with his use of social media the first time he ran for president. Now we're in a different level where there are various companies like Signal Labs and Pivot that are mining those conversations on social media to dig deeper into the information. So the candidate can make a speech and say, gee, how was that speech received by the voters?
In real time.
In real time. This is happening exactly. So you can see things, how people are responding to the candidates in real time based on real-life news events that are happening. In the olden days, there would be one time a poll that would be done on a candidate, and you would get what people were feeling at that point in time, who am I going to vote for? But as we know, things move so quickly today with a 24/7 news cycle and social media. So you get an immediate response from how the voters are feeling to a candidate or a candidate's message.
So off a few feet from here, there's the CNN magic wall, mm-hmm. which is just like what we see when we watch
just
anchors.
Like what John King mm-hmm. uses, absolutely.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And here we're standing directly in front of what's called the Command Center. Tell us what people can tap on and learn here.
Okay. So we have these sort of little... what would you call them? Dashboards. And you can pick any candidate that you want to hone in on. And again, this is measuring the social media conversation as well as traditional media conversations about the candidates. So they are grabbing the words that are being used about the candidates. So if it's a positive word, you know, Donald Trump, love, like, great, go, or it's Donald Trump, bad, evil, never Trump, all of these words are being measured and put into graphic design, fancy-looking imagery here, and that helps the analytics come to life for people.
So we've seen a lot of students come through this room mm-hmm. already today, and they are really engaged in this. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine you had young people in mind, but there are also a lot of older folks who are learning to engage on social media this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. We want everybody to come here and experience this exhibit. When you come into the exhibit, you can actually register to vote. You can start the process to register to vote. So it kind of goes from we're informing people about the candidates and the campaigns and social media, media literacy, and we're also trying to give them an idea of how social media is being used by the candidates and the campaigns.
And what's that over there? There's a little box, and you can sit down on a stool and have a chat with the camera?
Right, exactly. Social media is all about sharing your feelings about things, and so we wanted people, CNN Politics asked people, in this campaign, I feel blank, blank, blank. So you sit down there, push the button, record a 15-second message, and then you can send it to yourself for sharing on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, so you can tell your friends you were here and here's how you feel about the campaign this year.
So once again, we're in front of the Signal Labs Command Center, and I see this dashboard in front of me. What mm-hmm. can I do with this?
With this, you can find out what people are saying, and let's just select Hillary Clinton just for the heck of it.
Okay.
So here we've got Hillary Clinton. See what people are saying about Hillary Clinton, now showing on the big screen. So you see that word cloud, and you see a lot of words. You see Hillary Clinton, you see at GMA, I guess she was on Good Morning America, you see you see some feel the burn in the background there, because that's an issue for her. There are people who are feeling the burn. Violence, Democratic, vote, discusses, actresses, all these things that people are...
And the words in this word cloud are gathered from Twitter and Facebook and
yep.
Instagram, everything.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. And so Signal is grabbing all of these words. The bigger the word, the more times it's being used to say something about the candidate. So that's what's happening in real time.
And what's down here, this positive, neutral, negative?
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to click on this one. So this reflects the candidate's campaign issues and how people are talking about them. So they're grabbing the words that people are using about these particular issues related to the candidate and weighing them. So let's see, sentiment overall, 16% positive sentiment about Hillary, 77% neutral, 7% negative sentiment. on these issues. And then you see them kind of broken down. Top issue for her with positive feedback is education. Neutral feedback, trade. College, Edward Snowden, Benghazi, never Trump, criminals. These are things that people are saying negative things about Mrs. Clinton.
And then down here, we see a little graph-like interface, and it's got hours and times of day.
Exactly. So this is in real time. These are social media, traditional media, television, radio, all conversations that are happening about the candidates. Generally, when you look at this in comparison to all of the candidates, Donald Trump is dominating the conversation. Whether it's positive or negative conversation, people are talking about him. His candidacy has certainly riveted the American public. So here we have mentions by issue for Mrs. Clinton. A peak issue is college. The Islamic State is down below. Second issue for her is taxes, as far as what people are really talking about concerning her candidacy.
And what happens if we tap over here on the U.S., the map of the United States?
So this is just saying the volume of conversation about Mrs. Clinton versus Mr. Sanders. So 43% about her, 57% about Bernie. And then down on the bottom, again, you see the real-time mentions of all the candidates in these sort of squiggle lines. And the one at the top is the sort of golden color. That's Donald Trump. And as I say, he... You know, like him or hate him, he's topic fodder for talk shows, radio hosts, social media. He's certainly the one that people are talking about a lot. Bernie Sanders is kind of a close second to him today. And again, this is happening in real time. We're looking at 12:03:40, and this is how it's being done right now as we're speaking.
Okay, Patty, over here is the emoticon board, and I didn't think it was possible, but you can actually see how candidates are doing based on the little emojis that people are using to talk about their candidate.
You can indeed. And this is really a fun graphic visual interpretation of the way people are responding to various candidates. And we know emojis look different on different devices, and they mean different things to different people. So is this smiling face that has tears of joy? Okay, that looks like a good mention about Bernie. Other people were... I'm laughing so hard I'm crying. It may be mocking. So it's all kind of very interpretive, but that's part of the conversation. That's really interesting. Feel the burn is the largest emoticon being used for Bernie Sanders. That's kind of been an iconic symbol of his campaign. You see a lot of hearts. You see smiley faces. You see, you see statues of liberty. You see some patriotic things. You see the famous Edvard Munch, oh no, for Mr. Kasich. So it's interesting to see how people are responding to the candidates in this very visual, fun, conversational way.
Every candidate has at least one emoji that is a little brown squiggly thing with two eyes and a smiley face.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I wasn't going to mention that. Yes, indeed.
People who might know what that means. So it does seem that people are having fun with this, even as they're talking about things they're passionate about.
Very much so. And this is one thing that young people come to. You mentioned earlier we're trying to get everybody involved in this exhibit. And this is a very fun way, I think, to get conversations going among young people. Like, what do you think that means? Why are you responding that way? Why are you tweeting that way about Ted Cruz? So it's a fascinating campaign season, no doubt.
Well, this is a lot of information to process in real time. So let's continue our conversation at the studios of NPR.
Okay, that sounds great.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, joined live now by my guest. We were just on tape, but I have Patty Rule with me. She's Director of Exhibit Development at the museum. Patty, welcome.
Thank you, Chris. Like, glad to be here.
So people, I think, can start to picture what is at the exhibit. I'm curious about the responses that you and your colleagues at the museum are hearing from people. What are you learning about what people are thinking as they move through the exhibit?
I think people are very fascinated by it, the deep dive that you can get there. It's starting an awful lot of conversations. You get an idea of how well or how ill-informed people are about the campaign. On our opening day, we had some school groups there, and there was a young girl from Kentucky who was over in front of the Zignal Labs Command Center, and she chose a candidate, and I said, who are you interested in? And she went to Hillary Clinton. And I said, what do you know about Hillary? What do you like about her? And she said, well, I don't think I like Hillary because she's going to take away our guns. So I said, well, I don't think anyone can really take away your guns, but interesting that that's an issue that somehow has been, molded in her brain about what the candidate is about. So hopefully she left with a little more, a broader understanding of the issues and what's going on. But it's a conversation starter under any circumstances, whether you are for or against social media or what's happening this year. It's a lot to talk about.
I was interested to see everybody. There were visitors on the day that we went from all over the country, and everybody goes to that U.S. map, and you can tell where they're from because the first thing they do is look up information about mm-hmm. where they're from. What do you think is the appeal, not only of getting a sense of things on the national scale, but also drilling down to what's happening in their jurisdiction?
Absolutely. You know, John King has made the magic wall kind of an election night touchstone for people, and people go over there and like, is this the real thing? Yes, this is the real thing. People love to find out, you know, what their home state looks like, how the delegates are lining up, how you can zoom in on your county and find out, is it a red county or a blue county? So it's really fun. You can go back historically, back to 1980, to see, you know, Reagan, how that red dominated that map in those years. So it's really interesting on a whole lot of levels, a lot of deep diving that you can find out, demographic information about how and why people voted. So a lot of good information there, and hopefully school groups are enjoying that as well.
Props to John King, because it's not as easy to make that thing work beautifully as it appears to be.
Exactly. That's why he gets the big bucks. It is not easy to work, but it's really fun to get into it and play with it because there's just so much information there.
How did this partnership come about? What kinds of discussions happened, and who was at the table deciding that this would be a good thing to do?
Well, CNN approached us about doing an election year exhibit, and we've done election year exhibits before, more historical, looking at, you know, the press and the presidency. We did every 4 years, which was based on a piece of writing by Doris Kunz Godwin. And this year we decided this is a great opportunity to partner with CNN, since the social media campaign and the digital campaign is what everyone is talking about. So once we started talking to CNN Politics, they had other partners that they were working with, Signal and Pivot, and Facebook and Instagram came on board. So we just have this really powerful group of partners who are really the of-the-moment people and organizations that are kind of defining the race this year.
It's really proactive of CNN, and I think anybody at a major media organization would say this now, but in the past, it was the official media that controlled the conversation, mm-hmm. dominated the conversation, and clearly they have recognized that they're not the only voices, and they may not even be in the traditional media, the voices that people engage with most profoundly.
That's kind of the big story of this year, because, you know, there is no longer a gatekeeper. The candidates are directly responding to the public. Donald Trump doesn't need to buy ads. He doesn't need to be interviewed by the New York Times. He can tweet. His followers are tweeting him back. So that's really powerful, that you no longer have to worry about that gatekeeper who is going to write a story that may filter in or challenge you about how you're actually going to do the campaign promises that you're putting out in front of the public. So the lack of that gatekeeper is really a game changer. Just like in, you know, the 1930s, when FDR used his fireside chats, used the radio, this new technology, to communicate directly to the public when newspapers weren't so happy with his policies and his unprecedented bid for a third term in office. And just like in the 1960s, we saw John F. Kennedy and his family, so photogenic, so comfortable with this new medium of television, going directly to the American people, charming them. And whenever, you know, the news wasn't so hot, Kennedy would say to Pierre Salinger, let's get some cute pictures of the kids on the front page of the paper because, you know, again, look over here, something shiny. So it's all about, you know, getting the message out or diverting people from the message sometimes.
We're speaking this hour with Patty Rule, Director of Exhibit Development at the Newseum. They have a new exhibition now called CNN Politics Campaign 2016, Like, Share, Elect, about the role of social media in modern politics. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or follow along on social media appropriately using the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Patty Rule, Director of Exhibit Development at the Newseum. When we were at the museum last week, we talked to a number of students about what they were seeing and how they were using social media this election season.
I'm Grace Mattson. I'm 13, and I'm from Watertown, Wisconsin.
I'm Amanda Grotluschen. I'm 13, and I'm from Watertown, Wisconsin.
My name is Josie Roberts. I am 13, and I am from Watertown, Wisconsin.
So where do you all get your political information? Do you watch TV, internet, social media?
Most of mine's from, social media, and our social studies class is very active in talking about this.
I get a lot from my mom and my grandpa, and what's kind of cool is they both have, completely opposite views, so I kind of can get both sides.
So how does this exhibition compare with the way you guys talk about politics and study politics in school?
In school, it's more like facts and information, but when what you hear on social media and what you hear on news, radio, it's actually in the moment with it, so you can keep up with it. It's not like school where every day when you come to social studies, the teacher says, oh, we just got an update, when the update happened a couple days ago or a week ago.
So you feel like social media is more up to date?
Yeah.
Do you trust everything you see on social media?
No. Definitely not. I think it's more likely for someone to believe, what they're seeing currently on, social media because it's where everyone is rather than hearing something in school where, Grace said, it could be, days old.
So you girls seem media savvy. You seem like you look at things carefully. How sophisticated do you think your friends are about distinguishing what they can trust and what they can't trust?
We tend to share ideas whenever we get together, lunchtime.
Yeah.
That's really how we get through information that we've heard, what we've seen.
So you find it maybe on social media, but you still have old school face-to-face conversations about politics.
Yeah.
That was Grace Mattson, Amanda Grotluschen, and Josie Roberts, all 13-year-old students from Watertown, Wisconsin, visiting the Newseum last week. We're speaking with Patty Rule, who is director of the Newseum's exhibit development. Right now, there's a special exhibition through January of 2017 called CNN Politics Campaign 2016, Like, Share, Elect. It was funny when one of the girls, Patty, said, school is more like facts and information. And what they're getting, through social media is happening in real time. And so it's very compelling to them. Does it make you feel good to hear them say they're still having face-to-face conversations and working this out through discussion?
It makes me feel great. I love those girls. That's what it's all about. It's all about, talking about it, challenging your views, getting your views challenged. One of the challenges of the internet and the digital age is that you can tailor the news feed that you get to your particular views. So you can be a Breitbart Fox News person or you can be an MSNBC person. And you can never have your views challenged. And isn't it better? Isn't it part of being a democracy when your views are challenged and you get to understand what the other side has, what their point of view is, and perhaps a mutual understanding can be better, can come out of that. So that's one of the things that we talk about at the museum a lot, about sort of media literacy and realizing that, you can go into a deep dive, but, what's the point of view of this person? Who owns this publication? Who's writing this? What do you know about this person? So they're all asking the very good questions that we want them to ask.
The subject of media literacy is fascinating to me because it's not a subject that has always been taught in schools, and yet it seems today that a real curriculum in media literacy might be as important as teaching kids to do math or to read and write. Are you hearing about more schools that are adding this into the curriculum in a formalized way, or is it just kind of tacked on to history or social studies classes?
I don't know personally if schools are getting that added to their curriculum, but I do know that at the museum we have a lot of really popular media literacy classes that school groups can come and get access to free. And a lot of online information is available at museumed.org. So we provide curriculum to just those questions. When, there's breaking news about something, a difficult thing happens, our ed team is out there with, guides for teachers saying, how do you talk about this? What are the questions that you should ask? So we can be a real resource for both students and teachers to, talk about those very real questions. Because, it's very difficult, to know you know, the information that you're getting. You're bombarded with so much information. Which is good? Which isn't so good? How do you know?
I've been surprised occasionally to see a friend on social media that I know to be well-educated and someone who really wants to be informed. And, you know, adults get tricked into believing information that may not come from a credible source. And a lot of things that look like they are from a journalistic organization are actually from an organization that has a particular agenda.
Absolutely. And it's scary. I get the same kind of things. I get, you know, those emails from friends and relatives will say things, and I'll say, you know, there's a website that you can check this out on. This actually isn't true. Trying not to be like, you know, let the steam go through your ears. But yeah, it's really difficult. I mean, if grown-up people who've gone to college, who've got education, are seeing these things, we're all so busy. We're all so inundated with information. It's really helpful to be able to sort it out and sit down and figure it out in a calm manner and try to understand who's trying to do a good job of telling you what's really going on.
And there's also this phenomenon that if we hear even misinformation often enough, we start to believe it, even if at the outset it sounds ridiculous and not credible at all.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, look at the success of Donald Trump in his Twitter feed. You know, he is the one, he catches these words, you know, like you're lying, Ted, or you're, you know, Jeb Bush, low energy. And these words have a power to them. They get repeated and amplified on the internet in tweets and retweets and news coverage. And then, you know, you start to think, oh, yeah, that's the word that I connect with that person. And that's not fair at all. I think in one of the early debates, somebody said, just because he says it doesn't make it so. And it's the same on the internet. You really have to look at your source and is this really true? Let's step back from the edge here.
Speaking of stepping back, at the museum, you are dealing with what is happening here and now, but of course you go back into the history of, you know, the way that information has been gathered and disseminated. I would imagine you have visitors come in for whom this feels like ancient history, and you also have visitors come in who remember some of these big stories from back in the 20th century.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have school groups coming through, young people. We have baby boomers, people my age who are going to say, I remember that. We have 500 years of news history in our news history gallery. We've got a very exciting FBI exhibit that looks at how they are combating the war on terror with powerful artifacts like the Unabomber's cabin and the SUV that was almost used as a weapon of mass destruction in Times Square in 2013. We have artifacts from the Boston Marathon bombing trying to explain, again, the relationship between law enforcement and the news media, how that sometimes is cooperative, sometimes combative. These are all really important questions that we think people need to understand to contribute in our democracy today.
I was thinking particularly about the Unabomber's cabin exhibition. It felt to me when I saw it a little bit salacious that I wanted to peek in and sort of see what it looked like. And yet it did connect me in a really profound way with a story that had felt very distant in the news.
Exactly. I think that, you know, when you can relate to somebody, he lived like this. This is where he lived. There was no heat in there, no running water. You know, you can see the stains from his body on the side of the wall. It's really powerful, and I think it helps understand better. You can also see the shoe bomber's shoes that the FBI allowed us to put on display. And again, these very human things hopefully bring some understanding to something that is really impossible to understand.
And you can walk into the museum and see a pretty large section of the Berlin Wall.
Yep, 8 segments of the Berlin Wall, one of our most powerful galleries. And it's all about the story between, you know, the clash between oppression and freedom and how, you know, free expression helped to bring that wall down. The free flow of information could not be blocked by that wall as much as they wanted it to and ultimately led to that wall coming down. So that's one of our most powerful stories to tell.
There's a great metaphor there, too, because today in a lot of places there may not be any kind of physical barrier, but a lot of repressive governments are working very hard to make sure that their citizens don't get access to the entire internet, for example.
Yep. Free expression is under attack around the world. There's no doubt about it. In June, we have an annual ceremony called the Journalist Memorial, and we will add the name of 20 journalists who died in 2015. To symbolize all the journalists who are taking risks trying to report the news. And of course, we're seeing Islamist terrorists targeting journalists because they're challenging what people like, you know, what terrorists are doing. And as a result, they, you know, blame the messenger and are, you know, kidnapping, beheading people. It's horrible.
I've been really moved to begin to understand in shows that we've done on the topic to recognize that many of the journalists who are killed are not actually, you know, Westerners sort of parachuting into a foreign place. They're folks who live in these communities. They're from these places and just trying to tell local stories, and they are statistically at the greatest risk.
Exactly. And we have more than 2,000 names on the Journalist Memorial going back to 1837. And everyone thinks, oh, well, war correspondents, I get that. You're getting close to, you know, to conflict. You're getting close to bullets flying. I can understand that. But most of the people on that have been targeted for their reporting, just as you said. We have one person who was reporting on a hospital administrator who was removed from his job. And just the act of reporting on that got the people so infuriated that the person who was being removed, his son killed him. Hmm. It's so it is the local journalists who are really at risk. And, of course, we saw that in Virginia just last year when two journalists were on television outside Roanoke and were killed on air. It wasn't so much for their reporting, but a disgruntled employee. But nonetheless, it's a very real risk.
Do you think Americans fully appreciate the power that the First Amendment gives us?
No, I don't think they do. We hope part of our mission at the museum is to celebrate free expression through the story of the five freedoms of the First Amendment. And our Museum Institute does an annual survey about the five freedoms. And we find that more people can name the members of the Simpsons TV family than can name the five freedoms of the First Amendment that people have, you know, fought and died for. So that's part of our mission, to remind people.
One of the fun things that you do is, I guess, 800 different newspapers around the world send you a digital copy of their front page, and then you'll print some off and display them out front. How are decisions made about what papers go up when?
Any newspaper that wants to be part of it can be part of it. They can just email us at the museum. There's a link on our website to be part of it. So we try to rotate them as best we can, and we are looking for, you know, stories, obviously, that are really compelling and powerful. I remember when Barack Obama was elected president, that was such a historic moment, and there were people out in front of the museum weeping, taking photographs and weeping. Really powerful moment. You know, we forget the power of print media to kind of connect people to something. Just as you say, you know, physical artifacts just make a real human connection with people. Not that the internet can't too, but it's just an interesting different way of seeing that. So we try to rotate them up. And again, we do get, I think, almost 1,000 newspapers from around the world.
I was really struck in the early days of the internet when you could first get news from anywhere in the world without necessarily having a hard copy subscription. There are so many English language newspapers, even in places very far away from here. To read the perspective on a story that we've had reported to us in one way, it often sounds very different elsewhere. And it's not necessarily because people are trying to tell only their side. It's just we all have a limited perspective.
Absolutely. And that's something that's so powerful in the front pages, because you say, okay, basically the same things happened all around the world, sort of. I mean, obviously you want a local story, but how editors have put these things together in a compelling way to tell the story, and what stories are most significant and where they are most significant. So that's a really powerful part of it. It's a great civics lesson.
The booth that you have where people sit down and they record messages about how they're feeling, is the museum hanging on to those for posterity?
No, we can't hang on to those for posterity. Those are just going to go out the building. So if you come in, record your video, you send it to yourself, and then you can choose to share it on social media.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how seriously everybody takes it. Are you surprised to see that people are actually talking about the election rather than sort of laughing because they're in front of a camera?
I'm not surprised. People seem really interested in this. I mean, we've seen it, you know, in the ratings for the various debates that have happened. This you know, journalists are storytellers, and what a heck of a story this year has been. I mean, you have Jeb Bush, the, you know, Republican candidate who comes into this with money, with, you know, traditional supporters.
He seemed to be the odds-on favorite.
Exactly. You know, not to mention having a father and a brother who've been president, and he completely flames out. And then you have Hillary Clinton, you know, former First Lady, former Secretary of State, former Senator. You know, is she going to be thwarted yet again? You have Donald Trump, the billionaire TV reality show, who everyone says every comment that he makes, this is it, he's done, he's over, and he just grows stronger. So it's been an incredible story, an incredible year. People are talking about it, which is great. That's what it's all about.
Given that Mr. Trump really hasn't spoken a lot about policy objectives, what do you think his rise, his sustained candidacy says about the way media work today and about the importance of, for lack of a better term, controlling the message?
I think social media is about authenticity. And whether you like the real Donald Trump or not, he seems to be saying just exactly what's on his mind and not worrying about, you know, handlers who are shaping his message. Ooh, maybe we shouldn't say that. Let's test the waters. Let's see how that goes. He seems to be shooting from the lip and from the hip, and people are responding to that. I think a lot of people are tired of the sort of, I'm going to consult 15 people before I make a statement about anything. And clearly he is resonating with people.
You've been at the museum for 9 years now. What is it like to be in the building when a major news story breaks?
Let's see. It's very exciting. It's good. We have this giant Barco screen that was the largest indoor television screen, high definition, until the Dallas Cowboys got a bigger one.
I could have predicted that.
You could have predicted that because you're the Dallas Cowboys. What can we say? So that's really exciting. So we have master control. We've got, you know, 7 floors, 15 theaters, 15 galleries. With a flick of a switch and master control, you can put up whatever news event is breaking on that giant screen. So that kind of brings everybody together in the museum. So it's pretty exciting, whether it's a Olympic thing or a golf sudden death round or breaking news on the big screen. It brings people together.
Have you seen sort of traffic stop in the museum and people go out to that area where you can, from a variety of floors, actually see what's happening?
I have. And there was some soccer event that people were really invested in, and we were closing. It was like after 5, and our wonderful visitor services people said, hey, you know, people are into this. Let's stay up another 45 minutes. What's that going to kill us? Let them watch the end of the program. So, yeah, we respond.
You go all the way back to Gutenberg at
the
museum.
We do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have 500 years of news history, a lot of really powerful artifacts, newspapers from every war that you can think of, news books from, you know, the 1500s, historic newspapers that show great moments in history and how they were covered by the news media.
Are you surprised sometimes to see the way the style of reporting news has changed over time?
You know, it's funny you should say that because we've got an exhibit opening this summer about 1776 and how newspapers and printers back then kind of fomented the American Revolution. And we talk today about how partisan the press is. Oh, it's the worst it's ever been. It's never been this bad. Well, actually, if you go back to the history of the beginning of our country, people were either, you know, you were for the king or you were against him. And these very vicious conversations were being had in the print using that ye olde language where, you know, ye olde, you can, you know, kiss my whatever. So it was very, it was really powerful and, you know, we're amazed to think how in your face it was back then.
We're speaking this hour with Patty Rule, Director of Exhibit Development at the Newseum, which has a current exhibition called CNN Politics, Campaign 2016, Like, Share, Elect, about the role of social media in modern politics. If you would like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, where you can follow along with the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Patty Rule, who's Director of Exhibit Development at the Newseum. When we visited the exhibit at the Newseum last week, we talked with several people about social media and traditional media this election season. Two of the students we met were high school seniors from Winchester, Kentucky, both editors for their school newspaper. Here's Luke Cantrell and Shelby Gilkerson. I talked with Shelby first.
So you write a column for the school newspaper that's published on paper, but do you also tweet and Instagram and Snapchat about politics?
Yeah, I do, and a lot of us do. We have a social media, like, for our paper, so we have, like, Twitter, and we have Instagram and stuff just to do updates for, like, what we're doing, because kids can keep up with that easy.
How do you decide what sources you trust and which ones you don't online?
If they're like the Fox News and CNNs, like that kind of thing, and like the posts and those kind of things. And we always try to make sure that our sources are coming from reliable ones because that's important when you're writing. So, yeah.
All right. So we understand that you and Shelby have like opposing, mm-hmm. often opposing columns. Tell us about that.
Just at the beginning of this year, we just decided that for our paper, we needed to add in a little political thing because with the election year coming up and all that kind of stuff. And it would spark a lot of maybe controversy a little bit just to try to get people talking about the paper and everything. And it's important for people to be informed on these kind of issues and stuff in our school.
How much does social media figure into what your peers are understanding about the the race this year and the political process in general?
Oh, wow. It affects it a lot. I mean, kids are always on social media, and they get a lot of information and news from there. They figure out, you know, when the candidates are going to be doing whatever they're going to be doing, and they listen to, they follow the candidates on Twitter, and they see what they tweet, and then they retweet it to try to share it with their friends, and you really get everybody's perspective on social media, and everybody's able to show their voice and what they want to say.
That was Luke Cantrell and Shelby Gilkerson, both 18, from Winchester, Kentucky. We're continuing our conversation with the museum's Director of Exhibit Development, Patty Rule. You can join us at 800-933-5372, or you can find me on Twitter, at Chris Boyd Think. And we actually have a question based on Twitter. John Boehner has said about Ted Cruz on Twitter, and I won't repeat the entire quote because I don't want to use the language, but he says, he is Lucifer in the flesh. This is John Boehner on Ted Cruz. I get along with everybody, but he is the worst SOB.
Mm-hmm.
The question from our listener is, this is like the hottest thing on social media in politics right now. How does something like this take off? Is there any way that incendiary comments get lost, or do they always magnify via social media?
Mm. Well, I think they magnify, but you know how long that the half-life is going to be is the key thing. Certainly, this is not a happy day for Mr. Cruz and his new running mate, Ms. Fiorina, to have to come out and combat something like that on television. But then he turned it around to say, well, you know, if you like John Boehner, then you're going to like Donald Trump. I'm not your man. So he's flipping the story a little bit. But,
There's always been some meanness in politics. Do you think it's easier to say things that one might later regret because of the kind of technology that we have now?
I think that social media brings out both the best and the worst of people. You know, I don't know if you saw, there was a really powerful, PSA made of men reading the tweets that female sports journalists receive.
Yeah.
And
a lot of which are very sexist and violent.
Horrible and violent. And, you know, these are regular guys from off the street, and they were physically pained to say, I really don't want to say this. Do I have to read this? Because that was part of the PSA. So I think you can hide behind, you know, what's the whole thing? You know, the internet doesn't know if they're a dog. Well, if you can hide behind the anonymity of the internet, and you can say horrible things, and you have to be able to filter, you know, kind of step back from all that hate sometimes and just kind of say, wait a minute, you know, there's a whole middle ground here that's not being displayed. So I think it does bring out some anger in people, and they just feel like, well, you can't see me, I'm just going to say whatever I would say, which you wouldn't say to someone if they were standing there right across from you.
There's so much information out there now, so much is flowing at all times, that it feels like in some ways to be a well-informed person, you can never turn it off, right? You always have to have that device in your hand or a screen open. I don't know if you have thoughts on when it's appropriate to turn it off, when we can step back and actually sit down and think about what information we've been exposed to.
It is overwhelming, and I think you really do have to step back from it. I mean, I think, you know, if you're watching CNN and other cable news shows, it's their business to get you excited about it. Breaking news, here's something new that's happening. And if you're into the politics, you say, what's going on next? But that can be a little exhausting sometimes. I understand why they do it. It's their business. It's what they're all about. That's how they make money. But it can be exhausting. So you have to kind of step back and maybe look at the weekly shows or look at what's the New York Times saying, what's Politico saying, what's CNN Politics saying. These are the people who've been doing it for a really long time. Some of the other social media websites are just dipping their toes into the more serious journalism that they've been doing for quite some time. So I hope that there is a way that people can step back from it, put the cell phone down, just calmly have a conversation with a friend about what you think is going on.
Monitoring trends in the field of journalism, do you think there will be a future for long-form reporting?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I love getting my New Yorker. There's some, you know, you see the Pulitzer Prize winners or, you know, ProPublica, places like that, people who are doing really serious journalism. I think social media, you know, people say, oh, it's so superficial. Okay, I'll give you that. But hopefully it's starting a conversation. And it's not like you can't click on to get more information somewhere else. So it's giving young people a very real, very visceral way to connect with the candidates, what's going on. I think that's fantastic.
I was really impressed. I mean, I have teenagers myself, and I know they're very bright. But I was impressed to see all the students who really were paying attention. They may be looking to gather more facts, but this idea that younger people just don't care or only care about entertainment doesn't seem to be true.
It doesn't seem to be true at all this year. You've seen how the millennials have rallied around Bernie Sanders. I mean, well, he's a 74-year-old man, and he is, you know, they're getting Feel the Burn tattoos and wearing T-shirts. That Feel the Burn hashtag wasn't something that the campaign created. That was created by a digital strategist who was trying to rally his supporters. So she came up with that. So his has been a very organic kind of an expression of the people who really feel very sympathetically to what he's trying to do here. So again, that authenticity, that rings true and people are following that.
Is it accurate to say that news is also a form of entertainment? Do we just have to say that out loud? Or what's your feeling about that?
Let's see. I used to be an entertainment editor. So, you know.
Not that there's anything wrong with being entertained.
But there has to be, you know, serious content too. So I see, you know, how the candidates are trying to make those human connections just like, you know, JFK did and FDR did by making videos of themselves with their kids or when Ted Cruz was talked by BuzzFeed into doing a tryout for the Simpsons TV show, The Voiceover. And, you know, sometimes that works and sometimes not so much. So I can see what they're trying to do. I think it's a good thing.
If you had told me when I was 11 that I was going to a museum of news, I'm not sure that I would have known to be excited. I wonder if you see kids walking in like behind their parents or their teachers, not excited, and then are you able to watch them sort of change their affect as they get engaged?
I think our interactivity that we have at the museum is part of what really gets people engaged. And our mission is to champion free expression through the five freedoms of the First Amendment. So I think everybody's in favor of free expression. I hope everybody's in favor of free expression. We just had our first Free Expression Awards dinner where we honored people like Pussy Riot and journalist James Risen, people who are out there every day pushing against powerful people who would silence them because they think all humans have the right to say what they want to say, to express their thoughts. And we're fully behind that. And we hope that we get young people and old people excited about that idea after they visited the museum.
You do a lot of live events, which might surprise people because theoretically all of this could be done through digital means. What is it about bringing people together in a room and having a conversation that you and your audience still find really valuable?
I think people really like connecting with people that know a lot more than they do about various things. We had an opening panel when our CNN exhibit opened with Jeff Zucker and Jake Tapper and the social media gurus at CNN. And it was so powerful to hear them talk about, you know, why have journalists gotten it so wrong this year? And they were very honest about, you know, sometimes we talk to each other as journalists and we did not capture the anger that was out there. So it was very interesting to hear them give their perspectives about what's happening, you know, the impact of social media, how they do their jobs. I think people always want to hear from other people who know more. I think people yearn for information. People yearn to connect with other people and be more intelligent, get more information. And that happens at the museum every day.
Have you had the experience of watching people from other countries, other cultures come through the museum and really discover what the First Amendment means, what it guarantees in this country?
Absolutely. We have a World Press Freedom Gallery, the Time Warner World Press Freedom Gallery. And we have this giant 36-foot wide map of press freedom. And we partner with an organization called Freedom House. And every year they come out with ratings about how free is the press around the world. And so it's very visceral. You see, the red countries, not a free press. Yellow countries, partly free. Green, fully free. And people from other countries will come up and say, why is my country this color? What's going on? And I remember a woman from China came up and said, why are you doing this to us? We're trying so hard to get better. And I said, but it's not good yet. You know, you can't learn about Tiananmen Square and protest movements and journalists who cover the earthquakes there are being quashed. So it's a really powerful conversation starter for people of all ages from all parts of the country.
What would you say to Americans? What can we do to ensure that we don't take our First Amendment rights for granted in about 30 seconds?
Wow. Just take a look at any country where there's, you know, repression anywhere. You know, look at China, look at Russia, what's happening there. You know, people can't say what they want to say. If you criticize a candidate the way people are doing on social media without a second thought, you might be put in jail. You know, cartoonists who make fun of candidates in Iran are being jailed and beaten and flogged. So we take it for granted how very free and how very fortunate we are to be able to express our freedoms and our thoughts and our religion every day.
Patty Rule is Director of Exhibit Development at the Newseum. Patty, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris. I enjoyed it.
As we've been broadcasting this week from the studios at NPR, we've run into a lot of journalists you probably know. Tuesday, our producers got a very special tour of the newsroom and the elevators from a very recognizable voice.
I'm Susan Stamberg. I'm a founding mother of National Public Radio. I've worked at this network for 45 years, but not in this building, which is quite an extraordinary one. And when my son came to see it for the first time, he was a radio baby. He sat on my lap during the very first broadcast of All Things Considered. He'd say, when he saw this new one, this is not your mother's radio network. We're standing on a bridge now that goes over the fourth floor, a span from side to side, and we can look over, and sometimes it's fun to look down upon, the newscast people, the hub where in the morning the various desk heads gather in order to talk about the day's news, and when news breaks, it's jammed. You should see it. It just becomes electric because everybody pours over there to make quick decisions as to how do we cover this, what do we do about that. All kinds of breaking news is discussed and then generated from there, spread out and assigned. And we're looking at very mysterious-looking boards which show you the maps of the daily programs, but also show you incoming, where sources of stories are coming. And the engineering people, the ops desk right in front of it, can take a look and see how those various news streams are taking part. Further down, Morning Edition and the All Things Considered people, up on this floor, the fourth, the weekend folks, and the arts desk way back there. But I was called upon to orient people to it, and let me show you how I've done that. We're walking now towards the Bank of Elevators, and this will be my legacy, by the way, to National Public Radio, although I've been here from the beginning, first woman to host a nightly network news broadcast. And that was something of a contribution. Second thing was a cranberry recipe I give every year. But the third thing you are about to hear the minute we see a light go off at one of the elevators. You have to listen closely.
Going on?
The elevator lady. That's me. They asked me before we moved in here to please record all the things that would be needed to be her
newsroom.
There I go again. We'll get out. And this, I believe, is my greatest legacy to the network. And I only agreed to do it if they would allow me to say fifth floor lingerie. They did not, but they're stuck with me anyway.
All right, that was Susan Stamberg speaking to our producers, Jeff Whittington and Stephen Becker. Our week of Think broadcasts here in Washington, D.C. was produced by those two, executive producer Jeff Whittington and producer Stephen Becker. Our team back in Texas includes Shelley Canavy, Stephanie Kuo, and Gus Contreras. We'd especially like to thank everyone here at NPR headquarters who made this week possible, in particular our coordinator here, Emily A. Dagger, and our engineer, Jay Siz. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can peek behind the scenes of our week here at NPR on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Instagram using the hashtag ThinkInDC. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.